Okay. We are taking on the task of finishing Sefer Daniel today. Yes. No, I really have to, actually. And I have a class after this so that I have to get to. So I'm going to really try my best to stick to the time frame to the extent possible anyway. So we are in Perek Yud Aleph, Chapter 11. And we read about a mighty king, a first mighty king. That was in Psukim, Gimel, and Dalet, sentences 3 and 4. If you have the art scroll, because that seems to be the dominant form of Tanakh today, we're on page 1804. So, we said in Psukim, Gimel, and Dalet, sentences 3 and 4, that there was going to be a mighty king, and that mighty king we understood to be Alexander. Again, we're following Abarbanel's read. And he's mighty, and then he falls, and his kingdom is split up in four directions. There are four rulers who are not his equal. And then there were wars of the north and the south after his time, and we understood that to be wars between the northern kingdoms, the Seleucids, and the southern kings, the Ptolemies in Egypt. They make a covenant. The daughter of Ptolemy is given to the northern king in marriage with an eye toward unifying the kingdom around the heir that they will produce. The covenant does not stand. Antiochus' son in the north, Seleucus, and his concubine conspire to kill him. That doesn't work out. And that brought us to Perek Yud Aleph, Chapter 11, Pasuk Zayin, Sentence 7, at the very bottom of page 1804 in the Art Scroll Tanakh. Here we go. This is now revenge of the south. Ve'amad mineitzer sharasheha kano ve'avo el hachayil ve'avo b'ma'oz melech hatzafon ve'asab bahem ve'hechazik. Joyce, can you move this chair a little bit?
No.
At that point, a new king will arise. Okay? A new king is going to arise. I'm working with too many books. I'm going to condense my own books here, and that'll help. There we go. Okay. A new king is going to arise. This is a new Ptolemy rising, and he confronts, he attacks the forces who are arrayed in the north to take revenge for what was done. He comes into the fortress of the king in the north, we're at the top of the page in 1806, and he will act, meaning that he will act successfully against these people in the north. He kills Seleucus, he kills Seleucus' mother for what they did. Pasuk Chet, sentence 8. V'gam Elohehem im nesichehem im kleichem dosam. Their gods with their princes and with their precious vessels, kesev v'zav, silver and gold, bashvi avim Mitzrayim. He's taking it all as spoils to the south. Remember, of course, from the beginning of the book, the whole discussion we had a couple of times about the vessels of the Beis Hamikdash, our temple vessels. So taking the vessels of the other is a sign of domination. I think that's not something to be overlooked. So the king of the south attacks the north, takes spoils from the north, and then he will last for a long time from the northern king, meaning that he will now be safe from the northern king because he has conquered him. And then Ubab Malchus Melech HaNegev, this southern king, this Ptolemy, is going to go back to his empire in the south, Vishaval Admaso, he will return home safely. So the south has gotten revenge against the north. However, the north now comes back against the south. This Seleucus who was killed has sons. Ubanav Isgaru, his sons, the sons of this northern king, are going to now attack. They're going to, Yisgaru is a term for challenging. The Etgar in modern Hebrew is a challenge. So they're now going to challenge the south. The Asfu Hamon Chayalim Rabim, and they are going to amass many soldiers. Uba Bo V'Shatap V'Avar, he is going to sweep through, to flood through. There's that term, Shatap, as flood. V'Yashov V'Yisgare Ad Ma'uzo, And he is going to attack all the way through to the fortress of that king from the south. They're going to invade. Vis marmar melech hanegev viatza vinilcham imo im melech hatzafon. But the king of the south is going to attack back against the king of the north. Behemid hamon rav. He will raise a great mass, a great people, a great army. Vinitane hamon biado. And the many of the north will be put into his hands. So Ptolemy pursues them. I have in my notes from Abarbanel that one of the sons of Seleucus is actually killed and the other one retreats, just from historical perspective. So the south now overcomes the north, but Vinisahe Hamon Viram Levavo Vihipil Reboos Velo Yaoz. The great armies of the north are going to be elevated. Their hearts will be elevated, and they are going to kill tens of thousands. The Veshav Melech HaTzafon Ve'emid Hamon Rav Min Harishon, and the northern king is going to get an even larger army together with more allies. Ulekeitza Itim Shanim Yavo Vo Bechayo Gadol Uberechush Rav. And the result is going to be that he is going to invade in the end. And he is going to take great spoils and conquer the south. So the north comes back against the south. This is just a history, that, a history to Abarbanel, a prediction to Daniel, of the wars of these kingdoms who succeed Alexander the Great. And at that time, Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14, Rabim Yamdu Amelech HaNegev, many will stand against the southern king, the Ptolemy, Ubnei Paritzei Amcha, Yinas'u Lehamid Chazon V'Nichshalu. And here we get the Jews fitting back into the picture. The sons of the Pritzim of your nation. The word Paritzei sometimes refers to a ruler, but the way it's used here is generally understood to mean one who is Poritz, one who breaks boundaries, one who breaks through barriers, a person who doesn't obey the rules. So the Jews who did not obey the rules tried to set up a vision, a prophecy to support him. They tell this king of the south, this Ptolemy, that he's going to be successful. Well, it turns out that they're wrong, of course. Right? They had supported him, they encouraged him. Now they find out that they were wrong. V'nichshalu, they stumble. But the way Abarbanel understands it is that they get killed by the Egyptians. Now here, I brought you a source on your sheet, which we simply don't have the time to cover, given how much we have to do today. But I want to just explain to you what this is. It's a passage from a Gemara in Menachos. The Gemara refers to a gentleman by the name of Chonio, who set up a Beis Hamikdash. He set up a temple of sorts in Egypt. In Egypt, correct. A temple of sorts in Egypt during the period of the Second Temple. And this gentleman is named Chonio, and there's a whole discussion. The question is, if you have Kohanim, priests, who served in this temple of Chonio, and now they want to go serve in Jerusalem at the real thing, are they eligible, or do we view this as idolatry, having served there, and now they're no longer acceptable? And so there are actually different schools of thought in the Talmud about the nature of what's going on in this temple of Chonio, and that's what I brought you here. The Talmud uses it as an opportunity to teach a lesson about power corrupting. Because there are two different versions of the story of how Chonio ended up in Egypt. We do know that Chonio is the son of a Kohen Gadol, of a high priest. In the first version of the story, Chonio has a brother who is older than him, but the Kohen Gadol, Shimon HaTzadik, said that Chonio is going to be the one who's going to take over. The younger son is going to take over. Right? A replay of everything that happens in the book of Bereshit, where the younger takes over and the older gets upset. So that's what happens here. Chonio's brother Shimi is older, and he says, I am going to trick him. He tells Chonio, I'm going to teach you what you're supposed to do. He dresses him up in inappropriate clothing, and then he tells everybody that Chonio is doing this as an act of disrespect. He's wearing his girlfriend's clothing. And so everybody attacks Chonio, who runs away to Egypt, and and he goes off to bring offerings for idolatry. So within the first school of thought, the temple of Chonio is idolatrous. And they say, look at that. Look at the way that this fellow acted, Shimi, who never even held power, and yet he was so power hungry. How much more so do people become corrupt when they actually hold power? That's the first version. And then in the second version of it, Chonyo actually says, I can't take the job because Shimi, my older brother, should have it. But then he becomes jealous, and so he tricks Shimi into dressing inappropriately. The other Kohanim attack Shimi. Shimi tells them what happens. They then want to kill Chonyo, who then has to flee. But within this version of the story, the temple he builds in Alexandria is actually meant to be a temple for God. And they say, look at this. This is somebody who actually was righteous to begin with. He was offered power, and he said, no, it's not for me. My older brother should have it. And yet, look what he ended up doing to try to gain power. How much more so the way power corrupts people who actually hold it. That's the second version of the story. So I couldn't go through this without noting this, because some suggest that that's what's going on here when it says the Jews who were lawless in Egypt and stumbled, that this is talking about Chonyo. Okay. Back to the regularly scheduled wars. Pasuk Tadvav, sentence 15, Vayavo Melech HaTzafon, the northern king came back. Vayishpoch Solala. Interesting. What do you say? How do you say in Israel today, builders, right? The pavers and builders? The construction companies, they're called Solel Boner, right? Yeah. There you go. This is the Solila is a reference to this, the paving, essentially, or pouring a mound is the way they render it over here in this Tanakh. The idea is that it's fill. That's what they're using. They pour fill in order to be able to climb over the walls of the fortress, right? Vilachad irmiv tsaros, and they conquer the fortress in that way. Uzroos hanegev lo yamodu. The arms of the south will not be able to stand, meaning the might of the south will not be able to stand. Va'amim mivcharav, as well as his chosen forces, ve'ein kavach lamo, they cannot stand. Pasuk tetzayin, sentence 16. V'yas haba elav kiritzono, the one who invades from the north will do as he wishes. Ve'ein omed lefanav, no one can stand before him. V'yamod be'eretz hatzivi, and he will stand in the land of desire. A reference to Israel, right? He's going to stand upon Israel, the chala biado, he brings kala, a desire to annihilate, with him. However, he doesn't actually attack there. Rabbi Bonnell notes he does. This is now the person we're talking about. This king is Antiochus III. Antiochus III does not devastate the land of Israel. That's coming. Pasuk Yud Zayin, sentence 17, begins a new phase. I tried on your sheet to break this down by phases to make it a little more intelligible. So 17 to 19 is the fall of Antiochus III. V'yasem panav levo besokef kol malchuso visharim imo ve'asa. Ubas hanashim yitein lo lahashchisa. Now there's a new plot. This king of the north, Antiochus III, tries for a new pact with the king of the south, offering bas hanashim. He's offering his daughter, right? Just like we saw last week, there was a pact the other way. Well, there it's not offered for a pact at all, though.
No, but then Midian, he sends his princess to seduce.
So here, the idea is, though, lahashchisa, the idea is to pretend to make peace with the goal ultimately of conquering the south. That's the goal. Velosa amod velo lo sihya, but it will not last. It won't work. And the reason it doesn't work is lo lo tihya. She will not be for him. Meaning she won't work for her father, Antiochus III. Instead, she goes over to Ptolemy, her husband. Right, that's always the risk when you play these games.
Yeah.
So now he's lost his daughter. So the same panav le'iyim, this frustrated king of the north, turns to the islands. V'lachad rabim, and he conquers many there. V'hishbis katzin cherpaso lo, Biltikher paso yashiv lo. And so what happens is he turns to the islands. God has turned back his plot. His cherpa literally is usually cherpa is shame. Here they render it as insolence. They're taking it from the word cheref and cheruf. Cheruf is blasphemy. Cheruf v'giduf. So his attempt has been turned back. So instead, he attacks the islands. That's all he can settle for. But the Yashav Panav Lemauze Arzo Vinichal Vinafal Velo Yimatze. He tries to go home to the fortress he has there, and he stumbles and he falls and is not found. And that's the death of Antiochus III. He is not found. Abarbanel suggests no one knows where he's buried. He doesn't have one of these royal tomb type of arrangements. No one knows where Antiochus III is buried, and that's the fall of Antiochus III, which sets the stage, of course, for not Antiochus IV, but Seleucus. Seleucus first. We actually saw this referred to in an earlier vision. We had it hinted at in an earlier vision as well. Something involving horns, as I recall. But we'll see it now. Ve'amad al-Kano. Ve'amad al-Kano ma'avir noges heder malchus. So in his place, in place of Antiochus III, instead they will have one who ma'avir noges, who removes, literally, the oppressor, heder malchus. That's the glory of his throne. Uviyamim achadim yishaver v'lo v'apayim v'lo b'milchama. But in a matter of days he will be broken, and not through war either. And what it's talking about is Seleucus, the son of Antiochus III, who is killed by his brother via illness, via poison. And so, v'amad, pasuk chafalo, sentence 21, v'amad al kano nivzeh, the degraded one will stand where he had stood, right, is now going to take the place of Seleucus. He's called Nivzeh, the degraded one, because he's not worthy.
Here it says vile.
Vile, even better. Velo nasnu alav hod malchus. They didn't give him the glory of monarchy. Uba b'shalva b'chzik malchus b'chalak lakos. Instead, the way it works is that he comes in trying to snare people in with language that's going to draw them in. He tries to make pacts with people to gain their support. Uzro'os hashetef. There's the word again. Uzro'os hashetef yishatfu milafanav v'yishaveru. The arms of the flood. The flood were the Egyptian forces. So the arms of these Egyptian Egyptian forces are now themselves flooded before him, and they are broken. V'gam negid bris. As well as the prince of the covenant. They had a pact between them, north and south. Remember when the daughter of the northern king was given to, when Antiochus III gave his daughter to Ptolemy, there was a pact. It didn't work out for Antiochus III because she actually decided she liked Ptolemy. But the pact remains. So now, in attacking from the north, he breaks the pact with the south. From this pact that they had, he makes a trick. He makes a plot. And what he does is, he says, I'm just coming to see my sister. Antiochus IV says, I'm here to see my sister. That's his trick. And that's how he comes in, with just a small group. He doesn't bring a mighty group with him, because he pretends it's a peace mission. And that's how he manages this coup. Bishalva umishmane medina yavo. He's coming in peace. He comes to the feast that they hold for him, the riches of the land, the fat of the land even. V'asa asher lo asu avosav v'avos avosav. And this Antiochus IV will do that which his ancestors had not succeeded in doing. Biza v'shalal urechush lahem yivzor. He takes the spoils, he scatters their wealth, va'al mivtzarim yechashev machshavosav ve'ad eis, and he will set his mind to conquering their fortresses until the end of his time. Ve'er kocho, we're in Pasuk Chaf Hei, sentence 25. Ve'er kocho ulevavo amelech hanegev b'chayil gadol. He arouses all of his forces now against the Ptolemies in the south. Umelech hanegev yisgarel amilchama. The king of the south is drawn up for war. B'chayil gadol ve'atzum ad me'od, with great forces as well. Ve'lo ya'amod, but he won't last. Ki achshavu alav machshavos, because they have plotted against him. There are plots back and forth now. Ve'ochlei pas bago yishberuhu. Those who ate of his own food will break him, right? Death from within. V'chelo yishtof, they will flood his horses. V'naflu chalalim rabim, and many corpses will fall. Ushnehem hamelachim levavam lemerai. Each one, each of these kings, has evil in his heart against the other. Val shulchan echad kazav yedaberu, at one table they speak falsely to each other. Velo sitzlach ki od keitz lamoed, but it will not succeed. These plans will not succeed because there is an end that has been set and is coming. Okay, so Antiochus the Fourth, though, wins that battle, and now he turns towards Israel. And remember, this is the evil Antiochus of the Hanukkah story. So Pasuk Chavchet, sentence 28. V'yashov artzo b'ruchush gadol. He heads north. He's going home with his great wealth. Ulevavo al bris kodesh. But his heart is set on the Holy Covenant, meaning us. He wants to attack Israel on the way north. But he doesn't. V'yasa, he is successful in his endeavors. V'shav le'artzo, and he goes home. Lamoed yashuv uva banegev. Then, at whatever time has been set, he returns south. But he's not as he was before. He's not as successful as he had once been. And the reason for it is that ships come against him. The ships that come against him are whose ships? Kitim. So if you read Parshat Balak this past Shabbat, and you read Onkelos, and you read the commentaries, Vitzim Miyad Kitim, you know that Kitim is a reference to Rome. Now, the way that this is normally read, well, I'm going to read Pasuk Lamed first, sentence 31st, is that there's an alliance between the Egyptians and the Romans. They summon help from Rome. V'nich'ah, and so Antiochus the Fourth is defeated. V'shav, and he goes back. V'za'am al-Bris Kodesh. V'asa, and he takes out his anger on the Holy Covenant, meaning the Jews in Israel. V'shav v'yavein al-Ozvei Bris Kodesh. And so instead, he goes to attack the Holy Covenant. He goes to attack the Jews. Now, here is where it gets tricky. Abarbanel, all through this, has been presenting one narrative of what's going on in this chapter. He has presented other views also, but he's given one consistent narrative that is his. And he reads the next six or seven sentences within that view as being a continuation of the discussion of the fate of the Jews at the hands of Antiochus the Fourth. So you'll see, he talks about the profaning of the Beis HaMikdash, it says setting up an idol, and so on. And you can read it that way. The problem is that within the text that we have there for Abarbanel, he then goes back to Pasuk Lamed Aleph, to sentence 31, which we're about to read, and he starts that with Rome, meaning Rome's conquest of Israel. Which is, yeah, much, much later. You're now moving ahead in time to the first century before the Common Era as the first Roman influence, and then the destruction is the first century of the Common Era. So it's a very different prediction, clearly. But I'm going to work with what he does with Rome, because it flows well as things continue, and it provides for a very interesting read of the rest of the chapter. So starting with Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31, we're actually looking at the might of Rome. Uzroim mimenu ya'amodu. Arms that are mightier than those of the Greeks are going to rise. V'chilalu ha-mikdash, they will desecrate the temple, ha-ma'oz, the fortress, ve'isiru ha-tamid, they will remove the karban tamid, the daily offering that the Jews had brought, v'nasnu ha-shikutz mishomeim, and they're going to put the disgusting thing there. The mishomeim, they render here as mute. That's interesting. Mishomeim could be an expression of shmama, destruction, but they render it as mute. Okay. It means an idol that is set up in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. Umashie Bris, those who were wicked, either they made the covenant wicked, is one take, or remember that Abarbanel likes Josephus' account of Titus, in which Josephus says that Titus tries to sue for peace. Titus doesn't want to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, and it's only his soldiers that do it when they get frustrated with these Jews. That's Josephus' version of the story, granted that other historians disagree with him. But Abarbanel adopts that, and so he says Titus is the wicked one who offers a covenant. Marshiei Bris is how he, that's how he parses Marshiei Bris. Yachanif Bachalakos, he tries to flatter, to speak in a smooth way. But the nation that knows its God, they are actually going to grab this opportunity. Meaning, there are Jews who are living in Jerusalem, who are loyal to Judaism, who say, we're not going to fight the Romans. Let's try to make peace with them. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai tries to make peace with them. Abarbanel numbers Josephus in this group as well. Umaskile am yavinu larabim. The ones with insight are going to try to help everybody else understand. Ralbag here says that this actually refers to Kiruv. They do outreach to the Jews around them. V'nichshalu b'cherev u'b'la'ava b'shvi u'biza yamim. But ultimately, they are going to be conquered, and they will stumble by the sword, by the flame. They'll be taken as spoils. Ubihi kashlam, pasuk lamed dalet, sentence 34. Ubihi kashlam ye azru ezer ma'at v'nilvu aleihem rabim b'chalak lakos. I'm sorry, this is where Rabag makes his comment about the outreach. Even as they stumble, they will have some help. Some will come to join them. And ultimately many will come along to join them. Umidamaskilim yikashlu, litzrof bahem ulavarer vilalabain ad eis kate ki od lamoed. However, in the end, they're going to fall. Even the righteous ones will fall, and this is a reference, according to Abarbanel, to the fall of Beitar, the fortress in 135. It is for the sake of litzrof bahem ulavarer vilalabain, to whiten their sins. The idea being that this is an atonement for the sins of the nation, that they will ultimately fall to the Romans. That's the idea. So the Jews have now fallen to the Romans. The temple has fallen. Beitar has fallen in the year 135. We're now firmly 2nd century Common Era. And this king is going to do as he wishes. The same language that we used when we talked about Alexander. Right? But now we're talking about somebody else. So the question is, which king are we talking about? So according to Abarbanel, this is Constantine the Great. Pushing it yet further, beginning of the 4th century Common Era, correct? So this king is going to conquer at will. Vius Romain, Vius Gadel, Al Kol El. He will be powerful over all powerful ones. El there does not mean Hashem. El means a powerful being, people, forces, whatever. The Al Kel Elim, and on the mighty one who is above mighty ones, and that is a reference to God. Yedaber Niflaos. He will speak Niflaos. Niflaos are literally amazing things. What in the world is that? So, Abarbanel says, this is a reference to Constantine's adoption of Christianity. Constantine converts Rome to being an official Christian state, so that what he's, which historians discuss, but that's beyond the scope of today, but the point is, he speaks of their miracles. In other words, all the Christian accounts of miracles and the like, that those are the Niflaos. He speaks against God.
Yeah. Nifla King, the giants.
Nephilim. Yeah. V'hitzliach ad kol azam, and he's going to succeed until God's anger against us ends. Ki necheratza ne'esasa, because it has been decreed that this is going to come to pass. This is the way it'll have to be. Val elo hey avosav lo yavin, pasuk lamed zayin, sentence 37. He doesn't follow the gods of his ancestors. Constantine converts Rome to Christianity. He rejects the Roman gods. Val chemdas nashim, and upon the love of women. What are you talking about here? No. According to Abarbanel, and I've seen other explanations, but Abarbanel says it's priestly celibacy. The decree that priests would have to be celibate. V'al kol eloka lo yavin, ki al kol yis gadol. They worship the God of all. They worship Hashem. They just do it in, you know, with a very different set of ideas than we do. They've altered the Torah, but they believe they're worshiping the God who created the universe. The Elohah ma'uzim al kano yichabed, v'Elohah asher lo yedauhu avosav yichabed b'zahav u'b'kasif u'b'evin yikara u'b'chamudos. So he is going to pay tribute to this God that he's adopted. He's going to honor it with silver and gold, and he's going to do it everywhere. It says, V'asa in Pasuk Lamitet, sentence 39, V'asa l'mivtzirei ma'uzim im Elohah nechar. He's going to make many fortresses. These are churches, as Abarbanel reads it, for this foreign God, Asher Yakir, who he will recognize, Yarbek Kavod, he will increase glory, Bim Shilam Barabim Va'adama Yechalek Bimechir, he is going to give the church power over the masses, and he is going to divide up land at a price, meaning the church is going to own the land, right? Which the Vatican ended up being, I think, the largest landowner in Europe at one point. So this is his prediction. And then he moves to discuss a time of redemption, and that's going to take us into the 12th chapter. We're now in Pasuk Mem, sentence 40. We've got a lot to read here. But Ube'es Kates, in the end, Yisnagach Imo Melech HaNegev, the king of the south is going to do battle with him, the representative of the church. And now we've now moved to the time of the... What time have we moved to? When is the king of the south going to come attack the Holy Roman Emperor? The Crusades. This is the Crusades. The Talmudim, exactly. Masatzlav. The Muslims are going to attack the north. And that's, we know, the Muslims conquered the Byzantine Empire in, what is it, the 9th century? The Byzantine Empire is an outgrowth of Rome.
Just earlier than that.
It's either 8th or 9th. I don't think so. I think the Muslim conquest... Well, Muslim conquest cannot be... Right. The Muslims can't conquest...
Constantinople has fallen in 1450.
Right. That's still to happen. We're going to get there. But what he's talking about now is when the Muslims conquer the Holy Roman Emperor, which is the Byzantine Empire...
The Eastern.
Holding Jerusalem, holding... Empire. Yes. Yes, that's what he's talking about. I think that's 9th century. And so at that point, they sweep north. Well, Yistair alav melech hatzafon, the king of the north storms against him. Yistair like se'ara. Right? Berechev u'parashim, with chariots, u'baniyos rabos, and ships, u'baba haratzos, he will come through the land, v'shataf, that word yet again, v'avar, and he's going to flood through. So the northern kingdom comes back against the southern kingdom. Okay. Ubaba eretz hatzvi, and they will come into the holy land, the desired land, into Israel. V'rabos yikashelu, many will fall. Ve'ele yimaltu miyado, Edom u'moav v'reishis b'nei Amon. These will succeed in escaping. Edom, Moav, and the first of Amon. And I don't know, and Abarbanel does not explain the associations between Edom, Moav, and Amon and the nations of later days. Other than we usually associate Edom with Rome. V'yishlach yado ba'aratzos, he will send forth his hand in the lands. V'eretz Mitzrayim lo siya lefleita, and Egypt will not escape. This is talking about the Christians from the north, the Crusaders. U'mashal b'michmane hazahav v'akesef v'chol chamudos Mitzrayim v'lubim v'chushim b'mitzadav. He is going to rule over all of the stores of gold and silver and all of the treasures of Egypt, the Libyans, the Ethiopians, are all crushed by him as well. The northern forces managed to conquer the south. However, Pasuk Mem Daled, sentence 44, Ushmu Oz Yivahaluhu Mimizrachu Mitzafon, he is going to become frightened due to news he's going to hear from the east and the north, which is of the allies the Muslims develop from around the Mediterranean. He will go out in great force to try to attack these people, these forces who are against them. Vita pasuk mem hey, sentence 45. Vita ahale apadno ben yamim lahar tzvi kodesh. He is going to plant his palace, his tents, and his ohel is usually a tent. Apadno is often a palace. He's going to plant himself between the seas, lahar tzvi kodesh, by the holy mountain, saying, I'm going to stand against the Muslims. He will come to his end, and no one's going to help him. He thinks he has divine aid, and he's going to find he doesn't. Then, we return to the Jews. Pasuk Aleph, Parakid Bet Pasuk Aleph, chapter 12, sentence 1. Uba'isahi, on that day, Yambon Michael Hasar Hagadol Ha'omed al Bnei Amecha, Michael, the great officer who stands upon your people, the Jews. Vaisa Eis Tzara, it will be a time of trouble, Asher Lo Nihiyasam Mihiyos Goy, the likes of which had not happened from the time that we were formed, as a nation Ada Isahi until then. Uba'isahi Malet Amecha, call on him Tzakasubasefer, then your nation will escape all as is written in the book. Now, what is Michael actually doing? It just says he will stand. So Abarbanel suggests he's going to stand before God to plead on behalf of the Jews. Abarbanel also notes what I have in source number 2 on your sheets, the top of the second side. One of many passages in which the Talmud talks about this future time, time of redemption, in which, in this passage, it says, Ein ben David va ashtispashet hamalchus harasha'a al Yisrael tes chadashim, that the son of David, Mashiach, will not come until the evil empire has spread over Israel for 9 months, the time of gestation. And they quote a sentence from Micha, describing them lasting until Eit Yoledah, the time a woman gives birth, so that there is a 9 month period when we are under these other forces. So that's the ultimate redemption. But you think of ultimate redemption, don't think small. Okay? Don't think in terms of freedom from these various forces and so on. Think big. Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. Many of those who sleep in the ground will arise. Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. Correct. As the Rambam writes, when he discusses the resurrection of the dead, he says, you will find no clearer verse in Tanakh than this. You'll find other references sort of here and there, which the Talmud brings to support the idea that the dead will come back to life. But this is the most explicit reference here. Many from those who sleep in the ground will awaken. Eila lechayei olam, these for eternal life. Veila lecharafos lederaon olam, and these for shame, the ones who are judged to have failed. Yes.
Why many? Why not all?
Well, the way he describes it here is that rabim could mean great numbers. It doesn't have to mean most. Many just means a lot. V'hamaskilimias hiru kizohar harakia, and those who have insight will shine like the light of the heavens. Umatzdikei harabim kakochavim liolam va'ed, and those who provide merit to the many, and again many, great numbers, will shine like the stars forever. That's the prediction. So what he's talking about is indeed the resurrection of the dead. I brought you some sources on your sheets because you sort of can't discuss this without at least mentioning something about what it is that we're doing here. So that the Rambam I brought you in source number 3 says you can't have Judaism without this. This is a critical piece of Judaism. We know he puts it into his the 13th of his Ani Mamin formulation. Well, he doesn't write the Ani Mamin, but in his commentary to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, the Rambam provides a list of what a Jew must believe, and this is on his list. And then in source number 4, you find one side well, you find a description of what will life will be like in that next world, in which Rav says the next world is not a world of physical pleasures and so on. You are enjoying the presence of God. That's what the next world is. Right. That's Rav's view in the Talmud in source number 4. On the other hand, in source number 5, Rav is quoted as talking about a great feast that God is going to make using the Leviathan. Now, none of this should be taken in a very... Let me rephrase. When you get down to particular descriptions of what the next world is like, you can't take any descriptions as written literally. Meaning resurrection of the dead, that's written explicitly here. They're coming back. I get that. But when you get down to, is there a feast with the Leviathan, the male Leviathan, the female Leviathan, things like that, you have to look for deeper meaning in that text. That cannot be understood in a very simple and simplistic way. But you have a debate. Is it a physical existence? Is it a spiritual existence? I have two competing sources, both of them quoting the same person. That's a problem. In source number 6, you find the question of what happens after that. So, okay, the dead come back to life. Do they now live for 120 years and then they die? Do they? What happens after that? So in source number 6, we're told, no, that's it. Death is over at that point. At that point, there is no more death. Rav Sanja Gaon, in source number 7, discusses further about this question of what happens at that point and points to the multiplicity of views. And he says he is inclined to think that no, they come back to life and then they die and they go to whatever fate they have in a world beyond this one. In other words, Triyat HaMeitim does not represent the ultimate fate of this world. As far as Rav Sanja Gaon is concerned, it's just another stage. It's sort of proving a point regarding this world. This world can be perfected. But then after that, it's time to move on.
If one believes in reincarnation...
Yeah.
How does one...
What's the problem? Go ahead.
Like, who do you come back as?
Right. So the Zohar asks that question.
Yeah.
So this is a very old question. The Zohar asks that question. And the Zohar's answer is twofold. There are two different texts that you can read differently. One text says it's the... And I don't think they're actually contradictory. But one text says the body in which the soul perfected itself, meaning the last body it inhabited, the goal of reincarnation within those who believe that reincarnation is a Jewish idea altogether, because that's a debate, mm-hmm. but within that school, says that the goal of coming back is to perfect yourself.
Yeah.
So the last body in which you were, that's the one that would come back. That's on the one hand. However, there's a second point, which is that we have an idea within the Zohar and within mystical thought in general that the soul is not an indivisible whole. It can actually be broken down into different sparks, different aspects. And so part will inhabit one person and part will inhabit somebody else. And it could be that each body will come back to life with the spark that was perfected in that body. So you have that idea as well. And that goes way beyond the scope of what we're doing in Daniel. I've taught a series on the supernatural, and I probably will at some point again. But I couldn't go through these verses without at least raising the question of what he means when he says the dead are coming back. This is it's a real question.
Yeah.
Like, so what does this look like? How does it work? How long does it last? Do they have babies after that? Like, what is that? You know, what is that world like? And so on.
Is reincarnation a Jewish belief?
So that's subject to debate.
I never thought it was. I mean, I just thought it was up there somewhere.
It's not found referenced in the Talmud, other than there's one line in which, if you remember the story of Abigail and David HaMelech, Abigail and King David, she gives him a blessing. And the blessing is that he should be bound up in the bond of life, and his enemies should be slung in the spoon of the slingshot, the kafakela. And the Talmud reads that as a description of some kind of limbo stage. That not everybody is going to a reward or to a clear-cut punishment, but they're in limbo. So it could be that one could, and some do, try to link reincarnation to this limbo existence, but that's it. The Talmud has no discussion of reincarnation in any clear way. Rav Sanja Gaon says that reincarnation is not a Jewish belief. And he's adamant about it. He goes into in depth. He goes against it. The Rambam does not mention reincarnation, but there are many sources. The Zohar as the main one, but there are many sources that do see it and see it in classic Jewish texts. They'll read it into Psukim in the Torah, and so on. There's a pasuk in Iyov where it says God will do this with a man twice, three times. You know, bringing the person through this world, it sounds like twice or three times. Little references here and there that are just enough to confuse you. Okay. So let's go further from here, because we're not even close to being done. We've now seen today playing out of the wars of the Greek sub-empires. We've seen the Romans come in, conquer the land, destroy the fortresses, destroy the holy place, until Michael stands up, and at that point the Romans are done, the dead come back to life. And that brings us to Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12, Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Ve'ata Daniel, you, Daniel, stom hadvarim, seal these words. Ve'chasom ha-sefer ad eis ketz, seal the book until the end. This is not going to be for people to read and understand. There will be many possible meanings for it, and you're supposed to seal it and not explain it, which I think he did a good job of. Yeshotu to rabim, many will wander. The tir ba'adat, and knowledge will grow. People are going to suggest all sorts of ideas. And indeed, Abarbanel can be accused of this as well. You know, Sharon and I were talking before about the question of when was this written. And so many of the visions that are here matching historical events, so much so that certainly a biblical critic will look at this and say, yeah, because it was written after that. It's very easy to be right when you're writing about the past. Although that's actually not always true, but that's a side point. Historians do an awful lot of funny things. But the reason I'm bringing this up now is because really we've been bamboozled is too strong a word, but Abarbanel has sold us a way to read the verses of chapter 11 to make it fit, or chapter 10 and 11 really, to make it fit these Greek wars. You could, and others do, read it to fit other events in history. It's not, I mean, you saw there were certain passages where he sort of said something and you were like, well, does that really fit the words? Does that? And some of them we just skipped entirely. Ammon, Edom, Moab. So it's entirely possible that this is referring to something else. This is just, we've taken Abarbanel's read. Look at Ralbag, look at Rashi, Rabbi Avraham Bar Chiya. Abarbanel quotes them at times, and they're giving you a different read of these passages. So, you know, don't get too hung up on one read of it. Recognize, as is stressed here, you steal the book, and people will do whatever they want with it. Okay, Pasuk Hey, sentence 5. V'ra'isi ani Daniel. V'hine shnayim achirim omdim. I, Daniel, saw there were two others standing. Says Abarbanel, this is talking about Edom and Yishmael, the Christian kingdom of the north, the Muslim kingdom of the south, who have just been described. So they're standing there now, personified. Maybe it's their angel representing them. Echad heina lisfas hayor ve'echad heina lisfas hayor, on opposite sides of the river. Remember that this whole vision took place by the Chidekel, right? This had all been taught to him by Gabriel. So now, these two beings are present. Vayomer la'ish levush habadim. And he said, Abarbanel favors the explanation that this means each of the two of them said, la'ish levush habadim, to Gabriel, who had been clothed in linen, you'll recall. Asher mimal lememe hayor, who was above the water, you remember that. The ad masai keitz hapila'os. How long till the end of these awesome things, these mysteries? How long is this going to be? Or, Abarbanel suggests, Islam and Christianity both believe in the ultimate resurrection of the dead. So therefore, this is them inquiring, so when is the resurrection going to take place that you've just described? Voeshmaes ha'ish levush habadim, I heard that man in the linens who was above the river. He raised his right arm and his left arm, the arms paralleling these two nations. He raised them heavenward. He swore by eternal life. Meaning he swore that, yes, this is actually going to happen, this eternal life. You have other ways to translate. Vayishava b'chei olam can be translated as swearing by God who gives life to the universe. But Abarbanel says, no, he's swearing that there is chei olam, that there is such a thing as resurrection, as eternal life. Kilamoed Moadim Vachetzi. After a time, times and a half. Does that ring a bell? Uchechalos Napetz Yad Am Kodesh. At the end of the smashing of the hand of the holy nation, that's when all of this will come to an end. After that time, times and a half, we saw it in chapter 7, sentence 25, Idan, Idanin, Uplag, Idan. That's when the diaspora ends, that's when all of this will then come to pass. But Daniel says, surprise, Vani Shamati Velo Avin. I heard this and I did not understand it. No joke. Barbanel says it's actually more complex than that. What Daniel is saying here is more complex. What he's saying is, you remember this. I first heard Idan, Idan, and Upalig in chapter 7, and I didn't understand. At the time, he didn't understand. He thought it was all within the 70 years, and all four empires would be in the 70 years. So I thought that was all within the 70. Then I learned about the 2300 and the longer exile, and now I realize I didn't understand what time, times, and a half meant. Va'omra, and I said, Adoni, my master, Gabriel, ma'achris ele. So what happens in the end of all this? When is it? Va'yomer, but he said, Lech Daniel, go Daniel. Kisisumim v'chasumim hadvarim areis kates. This is sealed until the end. They're going to do whatever they want with these numbers, and they did. The church came up with all sorts of ways to read Moed Moedim v'chetzi. Yis bararu v'yis nablu v'yis labnu v'yitzarfu rabim. Many will be clarified and whitened, meaning that they will. They will gain their atonement through this, through the suffering that they will go through over time. V'hirshiu rishaim, and the wicked will do wicked things. I'm sorry, no, I misread that. That's not true. I'm not sure. You could read the opening clause of Pasuk Yud of sentence 10 in different ways. You could read it the way I just did, that many will suffer and be whitened and through time. But I think actually the way to read it is these times, Yisbaru, will be clarified, Yislavnu, will be whitened, Yitzarfu, they will be made clear, they'll be pure, Rabim, Vehushu Rishaim, the wicked will do wicked things, Velo Yavinu Kol Rishaim, and the wicked will not understand. V'hamaskilim yavinu, those with insight will understand. So that Abarbanel says here, there are three groups described. The wicked who do wicked things, those are the ones who say there is no redemption. Lo yavinu, kol rishayim, the wicked will not understand. That's a reference, he says, to the church who say that it already happened. So they just don't get it. V'hamaskilim yavinu, those who have insight, they're the ones who will grasp this and understand what the time actually refers to.
So is the latter part of the sentence modifying the first part of the sentence?
Yes. According to that read, yes. Ume eis, but now we get some times here. Abarbanel introduces this last couple of verses by saying that Rome, the Roman Empire, and the Christian Empire really is what he means, has two beginnings. One beginning is when they adopt Christianity, the beginning of Christianity. The second beginning, let me restate that. The first beginning is with the end of the Karban Tamid, the end of the daily offering, before the temple is destroyed, before the second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. We made reference to it already several times, the halting of the Karban Tamid, the halting of the daily offering, and how important it was. We saw it chapters and chapters ago, but we also saw it today. So what he says is that that's the first beginning of Christianity, when the Jews halt, when the Jews are forced to halt, bringing the daily offering. The second beginning of Christianity is the establishment of Christianity as the official religion of Rome, of the Roman Empire, by Constantine. And so he writes, Constantinople must fall, and then Rome can fall. And now we're going to come back to the date that you had for the fall of Constantinople, because that's where it becomes relevant here. He says, Umeis Husar HaTamid, from the time when the Karban HaTamid was removed, the daily offering was removed, Vilaseis Shikutz Shomeim, and this horrific thing, this disgusting thing, was put in place, a reference to the adoption of Christianity by Rome. By the way, for anyone who is offended by it, I mean, you have to recognize what he's talking about here, an empire that, for thousands of years, killed Jews. That's the way that it's going to be referred to, certainly by Abarbanel, who's going to see it that way, who has just been kicked out of more than one country and seen Jews in the thousands either converted to Christianity or killed or made to suffer from starvation and so on. So he says, the period of time, Yamim Elef Masayim Vitishim. Now, this is another one of those cases where you look at this and say, what did he do to those numbers? Is this really what's being predicted? The way that Abarbanel reads it is not Yamim as days or Yamim as years, but rather Yamim as 100. Gematria of Yamim is 100. Yud is 10, Mem is 40, Yud is 10, Mem is 40, add up your 2 10s and your 2 40s and you get 100. So therefore it's 100 plus 1290. In other words, 1390. Why? Because if you take the year that the temple was destroyed, that the Carbon Tamid halted, as the year 64, during the Roman siege of Jerusalem, and you add 1390 years, you get to the year 1454. Constantinople falls in 1453. That's close enough. We can round off our years. But that's the fall of Constantinople. And then he says in Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12, Ashrei hamechakev liyagia. Fortunate is the one who will wait and arrive. Liyamim elef shloshmeo shloshim v'chamisha, to the days of 1335. Which, when you add 1335 to 68, when you work with 1335 plus the 100, because you have the Yamim, that gives you 1435, that brings you to the year 1503, which you may recall from an earlier vision he predicted would be when Mashiach would come. That's when Rome falls. Now, clearly we're now living more than 500 years after that, and we're waiting. But that's the vision that he sees here. And he says, Ashrei hamechakev, fortunate is the one who waits and does not give up. It's very interesting in particular, because Abarbanel has a little segue in his discussion of these last verses, in which he talks about those who predicted incorrectly, and those who accused them of predicting events that would be in their day, and then that's why they got it wrong. And he says, no, they didn't. Rashi's prediction was for after his time. Others made predictions for after their time. So don't think that they were just predicting for their day. But Abarbanel himself predicts that it's going to be in his time, and he sees the evidence all around him. Because he sees the wars of the Christians with the Muslims, which are still going on in his day. It's post-Crusade, but it's still going on. The wars of Muslim Spain versus Christian Spain lead right up to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. That's after a key conquest that the Christians have made against the Muslims. And he sees that last diaspora as the Chevle Mashiach, the labor pains of Mashiach. And then we get the final verse. Ve'ata leich laketz. You, Daniel, go to the end. Which some explain, well, I'll read the whole sentence first. Ve'sanuach ve'sa'amod l'gorah l'cha leketz hayamin. You shall rest, go to your lot, to the end of yamin. We read as yamim, as days. Some say this is saying to him, you wait for the time when all of this will be fulfilled. Some read it as, fill out your days and then pass on until tchiyat hametim. Right? That's the statement to Daniel. I think that's the simplest read. But some suggest it means to live until the first Kates, the first end, the end of the 70, and that Daniel lives until the Jews go back to Israel to build the second temple, and then he dies. Some read it that way. But it seems clear that certainly we take it colloquially as a reference to Tchiyat HaMeitim, so that actually at a cemetery, when leaving the cemetery after burying somebody, classically people say that the person should Lech b'shalom v'sanuch b'shalom v'sa'amod l'gorah l'cha l'keitz hayamin. That one should rest in peace. That's where the phrase comes from. Go in peace, rest in peace, and rise for his lot at the end of days. So that concludes Sefer Daniel. After all that, a very fast summary. Just have to go to another shir, so I won't be able to say it long. No joke. But the central themes that we've seen in this book. Number one, going back to the beginning, we saw Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name via Daniel, refusing to eat the king's food. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, refusing to bow. We saw the miraculous divine response to them, the amazement of the nations at these miracles. We saw the punishment of Nebuchadnezzar and his at least partial rehabilitation, where he accepts that he was wrong. We saw the four kingdoms that will reign until they are replaced by this fifth empire, the holy fifth empire. We saw angels representing nations in heaven. We saw this major eschatological vision of God on a throne and the resurrection of the dead and the list of times. The overarching theme of the book is clearly that there's a divine hand controlling history, and the divine empire on earth, meaning us, we are supposed to be at the center of this human history. We saw Daniel function in two different roles. In the beginning, as this pious exile, interpreting royal dreams, continuing to pray to God even when it meant facing the lions. And then the second half, we saw him as a Jewish leader pleading with God on behalf of the Jews and seeing visions about when the redemption will come. We saw predictions of the fall of Babylon. We saw the corruption of the Babylonian leadership, the impact that Daniel has on Nebuchadnezzar. And then we had those big visions, the four empires, the vicious beasts, the time, times, and half a time, the 2300, and then the time, times, and half a time at the end. And may we see the fulfillment of chapter 12 as well.